You're also smart. You're also this and that. And it's like, well,
great white voice. What's going on, everybody? Welcome to another episode of American Theses. This is Arjun.
And I'm Akash.
We are on the road. We've taken the podcast on the road, and we are up in San Francisco today.
Literally just got here.
Minutes ago.
Right.
Cool town so far. We are very fortunate to be sitting in the conference room with a nice exposed brick. It's very San Francisco to me. But we are at the offices of the Asian Americans Advancing Justice - Asian Law Caucus. That's where we are. And we have the great fortune of sitting here with Arthi Kohli, who is an attorney or lawyer here. Which is the correct term?
I'm the deputy director here.
Damn.
You could say either.
No, I should have done
it. I don't think you can say either. I think she lets you know which one you need to say.
You are the deputy director of... So what? Before we dive into anything, let's talk about this title for this organization.
Sure. It is,
there's a lot to unpack just in that.
Right.
A lot of words.
Yeah. Two.
I'm the profound one.
Yeah.
A lot of words. No, Asian Americans Advancing Justice - Asian Law Caucus. I think that's what he meant.
Oh, that title. Unpack. Okay.
Oh, that title.
I was like,
not
my title?
No.
I don't know. Okay. Yeah. Oh, yes. Yes. So our original name was the Asian Law Caucus, and that is from the early 1970s. So we're pretty old. We're started by a group of lawyers who went to Berkeley Law School and had these Chinese immigrant parents come to them saying, we really need help because our kids, when they hang out on the street, keep getting arrested by local San Francisco police who think they're gang members because they're hanging out on the streets of Chinatown. And so that was, you know, it became clear to the lawyers who were Asians, who were mainly East Asians, Japanese and Chinese American, that there weren't really any services for this community. And you know, it was like a storefront kind of operation where like the money was kept in the fridge and like, you know, it was really like this.
Right.
There was no exposed brick or nice building or conference table or, you know. But
it started almost like a passion project.
Yeah, right. Totally. But here we are now, and we have almost 30 staff.
Wow.
We have a budget of approximately $3 million a year. All of it is, we don't charge for any of the services that we provide.
Wow.
All of it is raised mainly, you know, that's one of my jobs is to help raise the money. The beginning of the title, Asian Americans Advancing Justice, is a new partnership. And that is a partnership we embarked upon a few years ago. And the idea is that we need a progressive national Asian voice.
Yeah,
and
true.
That, I mean, you've got other communities, you know, have national recognition and have organizations that represent them. You know, you can, I guess, argue as to like the effectiveness of those organizations, but they exist.
Would it be a fair? Would this be a fair parallel between the NAACP and what you're trying to create with this partnership?
Yeah, I think it's kind of like we're a little bit like the NAACP, but we're also like the Asian ACLU. We very much
have. I see what you're saying.
We have very much a civil rights bent and a civil rights lens that we're always looking at, you know, who are the most vulnerable members of our communities and what are we going to do to change the system? So it's not just, yes, we provide direct services. Like if you are low income and you, you know, are facing deportation, we might represent you.
Right.
But it's more like, what are we going to do to change the immigration system so that people aren't getting deported?
Right. So you're trying to you're upstreaming the situation to go to the root of the problem.
Right.
To see how we can stop people getting deported in the first place.
Right. That's just one of the pieces.
Well,
yeah.
So this brings to segues perfectly to the bigger question. It's you are South Asian.
Right.
You work. You were saying that this organization started as, you know, by primarily East Asian lawyers. When did South Asians become a part of that, of this mission? And kind of an interesting question, is the voice that we you are aspiring to, how are you navigating it when so many people think of it as South Asian versus East Asian?
Yeah, I mean, it's this interesting situation because our definition of Asian is so expansive. We actually go west. We go pretty far west. So we include Middle Easterners.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Okay. And in terms of when South Asians, I think South Asians have been involved probably since the 90s, but really when it became more, when we became more prominent in these issues is after 9/11.
Right.
Because you had special registration from, you know, of people from South, including from South Asian countries. You had targeting of South Asians for racial profiling. You had all kinds of stuff happening. And it became, and what was amazing was actually the Japanese American community, because they had gone through internment, really stepped up and said, you know what? We are not going to have this kind of America again, where because of your race and ethnicity, you get targeted. And we are going to show up for a broad array of, you know, other Asians. And right now, it's going to be folks. And we have a term, we call it Amemsa communities. It's this unique term. It's Arab, Middle Eastern, Muslim, and South Asian. So
Amemsa.
Amemsa. It's this, you know, it's not
a
term.
Name for the podcast.
Yeah.
We keep joking about how we need to, how to be as inclusive as possible. It's
yeah.
A small.
Yeah. Well, there you go.
I'm gonna take a, put a pin in Amemsa for a second.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm gonna put on my naive cap. Uh-huh. And I feel like this is gonna happen several times.
That ain't
throughout.
Your cap. That's your natural skin.
Fair enough. So I'm just gonna own that, raise my hand and say, tell me about the special registration, because I was unaware about this.
So special registration was a program where non-citizen men over the age of 16 from 25 countries were forced to go to the immigration authorities and register, give them their address, and be subjected to questioning. And it was just based on where you were coming from and where, you know, where you were an immigrant from. So this included Afghanistan, Bangladesh, Indonesia, Pakistan. So there were, and other countries, Yemen, Sudan. But it was, there was no, like in the law, we often talk about, like, if you're getting arrested or interrogated by police, there has to be some reasonable suspicion that you did something wrong.
Right.
But it wasn't based on any action. It was just based on your ethnic identity and your gender.
Right.
And
there's
so
there's no probable cause for any of this.
No, and it was a, I mean, it was a racial profiling program instituted by the government as a, you know, in their foolhardy attempt to, you know,
create safety.
Yeah. And
it was only citizens of those countries. Right, it was people that, not people that were living here for, was it, or is it retroactive? Was it people that were just coming into the country after?
No,
or was
no,
it like,
it's people who immigrants here. So like, you know,
right. So
like you
have
could
been
be a green card.
Like 10, right.
Yeah,
wow, wow,
yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It, you know, it, it, yeah, you could have lived here for 40 years. It doesn't matter.
So let me take you back to Amemsa, because I'd be curious to hear. You said that you guys define Asian in a different way. I would love to hear how you guys have codified what that means to be Asian.
Yeah, I mean, to us, it's broad because for a number of reasons. One, we think there's more power to have to include everybody.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And, you know, geographically, you could make an argument that all of those folks belong in it,
right,
in those categories. And then you have smaller groups that, you know, they have no other place to align themselves, right?
So welcome them in.
Yes, of course. And also the issues that they're facing are the same issues that other parts of the Asian American community are facing. So, you know, there is alignment in terms of the impact.
Groups also underrepresented in the sense that, like, this started because there was no Asian American representation, I guess is the word.
Right.
Are those groups also lacking for representation? Is that why you included them? Or are they also like, there's nobody representing Middle Eastern people? There's no organization.
Right. Well, I don't want to say we're the only ones representing them, but we are doing it in a pan-Asian way. Often what you have is other orgs that are like particularly maybe targeting one ethnic community, or they're doing it based on religion. Like, you know, like Muslim Advocates or the Council on American Islamic Relations, or you have, you know, like the Organization for Chinese Americans, or, you know, like you've got these different groups.
Very highly specialized.
Right, which they have a very important role that they play, but we are trying to build broader power.
So this brings up a question, because when I think about community, when I think about community building, when does the community stop,
That's right.
My question then becomes, when you're talking about alignment of causes, well, let's just take immigration.
Right.
Latin America.
Right.
So how would you navigate the thought process behind, should we align with them also? Why are we not? Like, how do you do that?
You know what? That's a really important question, because we actually do align with folks from not just other ethnic communities, but based on issues like, you know, folks who are part of the movement for Black Lives, you know, on criminal justice reform.
Right.
It's actually an issue that we also work on. Mm-hmm. So I think community doesn't stop just because you have a certain title or a certain community that you're representing.
Right.
And in fact, it shouldn't. You know, part of our job is to build bridges and work with other communities.
But do you find that the building bridge becomes difficult when we have said this is a different organization? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
How do you confront that obstacle of we are different than you because we are Asian and you are Latino?
Right.
But we also deal with the exact same thing. So then it becomes a question of like, so if there's the bridge, what is the difference? Why aren't we just one?
Because I think there are some unique issues that do impact our community that aren't the same for other communities.
Right.
And so our role is to address those unique issues, whether it's like language, whether it's some cultural pieces, whether it's, you know, like we have a lot of Asians who came as refugees. And so the deportations that they're facing them as green card holders who came here, you know, as children. That does happen in Latin American communities, but not necessarily in the same way that it happens for Asians.
Gotcha.
So, but it is important. I think it's just because you are an ethnically identified organization doesn't mean that you shouldn't show up for other people. And in fact, you have to show up for other people if you want other people to show up for you.
Well, it's so interesting because I've been having these conversations a lot more with my friends of different ethnic backgrounds around whether it's Black Lives Matters or anything, or just whitewashed out, or certain things that have come up. And it's interesting that I do feel like we have to have the conversation. I feel like we have to still be telling people that we're all in this together.
Right.
And that's an interesting, it's a little discouraging at moments that I find myself in a position where I'm like, hey, I can support you, but will you also support me in what I'm struggling, whatever I need help with? You know what I mean?
What do you mean you're discouraged by that?
Because in my head, I would like it to be where we all know that, like, look, we do have to step out. Just because this is our community doesn't mean that we don't show up for their community.
Right.
Because there's a bigger umbrella that we are all disenfranchised, or that none of us are a part of the power structure.
Right.
But I feel like that a lot of people are still stuck in, well, this is my community, and my community is different than your community.
Right.
So we're not actually in this together.
Right.
I
mean, I think there is some element of that. I think for members of our communities who are recent immigrants, there is so much change for them, and that feeling of like lack of groundedness when they show up in a new place and are trying to orient themselves.
Right.
So there is sort of a desire to just go find your tribe, you know, find your people that who understand your cultural background and your history and all of that. I'm not excusing it. I'm just like trying to understand, you know, like
sure.
the, I think.
But I think about like the older aunties and uncles, they'll sometimes
right.
be like, well, not as invested right. in Black Lives Matters.
Right.
Or there is an
right.
anti-Black
right.
sentiment. Or,
right.
But there's like not even that that they're not invested in that, but there's a like
oh, yeah,
a,
they're bringing
a push
it with them.
Back.
Yes.
And
yes.
and that that can be, that's just, it's important to just what you said, that just because you're an ethnically identified organization or person doesn't mean that you can't stand up. That's, I guess that was the, what I'm responding
yeah.
to.
And I think what you're pointing to is really important, which is there is a learning curve and also a lack of engagement with
mm-hmm.
those aunties and uncles and folks
right.
About how some of the struggles that they had were are directly connected to the same to the struggles that you know, Black communities are facing or Latino communities are facing.
Right.
And they don't necessarily see the connections.
Right.
Because they might be of a different class or they might have had the privilege of education, higher education, you know? And,
right.
And I don't know if enough of us are talking or engaging with the aunties and uncles or, you know, with that first
or whoever
generation.
That community,
yeah,
yeah. Whoever that is
yeah.
that's feeling that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Deepa had a beautiful, you know, where she said, you know, how what is your pledge to disrupt? And I think that that's one of the examples that she's been getting a lot of people pledges to, like, have that conversation that's
right.
not comfortable in the family
right.
to do. But coming back to the work that you guys are doing,
mm-hmm.
I would love to hear some of those unique issues that are that our community is facing
mm-hmm.
And what is... Because, again, and this speaks to, again, the model minority thing that we were
right.
striking before. There's
right.
such a perception that as a model minority community that we don't have to avail ourselves of the legal system. But obviously we do. There's, you know, there's
right.
30 staff and $3 million a year being poured into this. This is so what,
right.
if you would feel comfortable speaking of what some of those specifically are.
Sure. I mean, it's a range of issues. I mean, one of the main things that we were just talking about earlier was, you know, the 1.5 million undocumented Asians that are in this country, which
yeah.
is a lot of people, and 500,000 of them are South Asian.
Now, off the podcast, sorry, you might have been getting this, but you mentioned that the number had skyrocketed in the last 3 years.
Yeah.
And you said you didn't really know why. But how have you guys dealt with that rising number? How has that affected how you operate day to day here?
Yeah, so what's challenging for us is that, well, we have a couple of different programs. We have an undocumented youth program
mm-hmm.
where we're trying to engage undocumented youth and build leaders.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, really our philosophy is that directly impacted people are the best spokespeople for their issues. You know,
sure.
we
yeah.
as lawyers always try and step back
right.
and try and play a supportive role
and guide,
right. But not, you know, we're not speaking for you. If you are ready to speak for yourself, that is, you know, that's way more powerful.
Absolutely.
You know, and so we've been trying to do outreach to undocumented API youth. And I have to tell you, it's really challenging.
Yeah.
It is because, I mean, and this is a difference, for example, with the Latino community, because I think at least in the Latino community, there's a level of support and understanding from the documented Latino community for the undocumented folks.
Mm.
But in the Asian community, it doesn't, like, it's like, there's still, I think, a level of fear and shame, and parents just, you know, I think, you know, you can understand why, but, you know, telling their kids that this is not something we want you to talk about.
Yeah. I think we can understand why, but I think it's super important for us to talk about why.
I agree.
So that
yeah.
we can pour. Oh, my nanny says this, and I'm seeing you. Well, I can't tell you that because it's supposed to be a surprise. You don't listen to this, nanny, but I'm
yeah.
seeing you in a couple weeks. But my nanny always says sunlight is the best disinfectant. And
yeah.
I think that sometimes with issues like this, obviously what I think that We can all agree that what we're trying to do in this, or what I want to do with this conversation, is hopefully bring light to that we don't, that we shouldn't be ashamed of that.
Right.
So I think the best way to do that is to unpack why we do feel shame around that.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a number of things, like I'm sure, you know, status and stature and like are a part of our culture. Right. Like, mm-hmm. you know, how you're showing up. And, you know, I think it is a matter of I'm sure there's some aspect of that that colors people's ability to talk about their status.
It's almost like the model minority thing becomes a cage for us to that's not allowing us to embrace the whole community.
Yeah. And I mean, I think there is an expectation because of the way that we a lot of South Asians came here post 65, and it was, you were only allowed in if you were had certain, you know, higher education. Mm-hmm. So we have like this skewed, and this is, you know, also perpetuates the model minority myth. Mm-hmm. So we have this skewed vision, and like you'll see non-South, you know, like Anglos basically being like, you're also smart, you're also this and that. And it's like,
well, great white voice.
Yeah.
Great white voice.
And it's like, well, you do understand why there is this like skewed community.
Yeah, people don't.
It was a creation of our immigration laws.
I didn't for the longest.
Yeah,
but it's an easy thing to buy. It's a great thing to buy into. We're just the best.
Like, yeah, I know.
Yeah, we are all so smart. That's like an easy thing to buy. Then you're like, oh, I had to travel to England and I saw a lot of dumb South Asians, and I was like, yo, y'all are cavemen. What is this? This is not us.
Can you talk about 65 for those that aren't aware of what that was? I think it'd be just nice to have, rather than us who are idiots,
much no like the South Asians in England. Idiots.
Somehow you still got in, though. You were here. Yeah.
Oh, no, because we had smart parents.
Yeah, we had smart parents.
Listen, man.
Yeah.
We stupid.
No. So in 1965, there was a law passed that got rid of per country restrictions. So before 65, if you were from anywhere other than Europe, you were not going to get in because you had maybe 100 people from each non-European country were allowed in. It was like really...
See, I didn't even know this. That's wild.
Yeah, no, it's wild. So it's like, it was, and actually we have the civil rights movement to thank for that law.
Huh.
Because it was, you know, part of the narrative of the civil rights movement was like, our laws should not be racist and should not be based, we shouldn't be restricting people in our country based on their national origin.
See, aunties and uncles, without the black folk fighting for rights, we wouldn't even be here.
Yeah, exactly. So post 65, the restrictions were lifted, but then there were certain labor shortages in this country. So they needed engineers, mm-hmm. they needed doctors. So they started recruiting people. I mean, my dad was doing a PhD and he got some some letter saying, do you want to sign up for a visa? And that's how we got here.
It was like, wow. It was like we were athletes.
Right.
Yeah.
Going to Division I.
Yeah. I mean, there's this whole literature.
My uncle got a scholarship and had a little money on the side.
Right.
Flew him into Rice. Be an engineer.
So, not the letters that you're talking about were not just to go to a college. They were just to come in and start working.
Right. He didn't. Yeah, that's right. It was because of his level of education that he was able to apply for a visa for all of us. We all came with green cards. We didn't even come with temporary workers, H-1B and all this.
Wow.
No. And so it was a moment in time where I think a lot of those folks who came post 65 don't even understand the more recent migration, right?
So can you talk to the more recent migration as to that? There's no, it's now... Not there's no recruitment happening, I'm assuming, anymore.
Well, there is recruitment, but it happens under this H-1B program, the temporary worker.
Right, it's the work visa, of course.
Yeah, and, you know, there are a lot of problems with that kind of... Whenever you're a guest worker, mm-hmm. no matter if you're a high-end guest worker or a low-end guest worker, you are basically... Your labor rights are, you are more, you can be exploited more easily.
So you're talking about like held overtime more?
Yeah, like you're, yeah, because you're, I mean, the visas, in order to change, your employer is the one providing your visa.
Right.
So if you want to like change jobs, you have to go through a lot.
Right.
In order to do that.
Right.
You know?
And corporations and bosses usually know this.
Right.
So it places you at an it takes away the one leverage that all of us as employees have is that I can go and get another job.
Right. So these are all protections that are, you know, being talked about. It's not stuff that we work on here because that's, I mean, our main clients are low income people who don't have any other way to get legal help.
Right.
You know,
And probably do you come in contact? Mm-hmm. Do you come in contact with a lot of them? Don't even know their rights to begin with.
Totally.
Right.
I mean, we work a lot on wage theft. There's an incredible amount of wage theft of immigrant workers. You know, often they're limited English speaking.
Right.
They don't know that they deserve breaks and overtime pay. And I mean, we've gotten like, and this is like restaurant workers, like people in the transport, you know, who drive those airport shuttles, you know, like.
Like this is, it's such important work for people to know their right, because it will affect them on such a massive level.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to be honest. I'm sorry to interrupt, but what's surprising to me is, and this is going to sound really ignorant, but whatever, what's surprising to me is how many Asian Americans come here with the lower end H-1B visas, like we're working airport shuttles and stuff like that. Like, I just, in my mind, if you're coming over, you're getting a high-end job.
Yeah, or, you know, you have people who are undocumented who might be doing those jobs.
Right.
Or you're, you know, I mean, what happened is the people who came post-65, you know, through those high-end categories, then brought other relatives over. Right, okay. Who may or may not have had higher education,
okay.
Right? So that was part of, you know, like
the process.
Broadening, mm-hmm. Right? But then you also have people like, you know, I still remember I met someone who crossed the border from Mexico, who came through South America, that's through Central America.
Yeah.
So it's not uncommon. I mean, people have come, you know, just like, you know, other undocumented workers have.
I'd like to transition with the last section of time that we have with you to two things. You were saying that you guys are doing things to help create a national, or that you want a national voice, so you're working on the national level with things.
Yeah.
What has been the obstacles you are facing, either in creating the national identity or actually implementing that on a national scale?
Yeah, no, it's
just that small question to unpack in the last few.
How many days do you have? Yeah.
As long as you've
right.
got.
Well, I think there's a number of obstacles. One is resources. You know, I think the model minority myth does make it hard for us to make the case that actually Asian communities need resources in order to...
When you talk about resources, you mean financial resources? Do you mean physical resources?
Yeah, I think mainly financial.
Right.
You know, basically, you can't, like, we've got our day-to-day work here, but then we are now trying to engage at a national level. That requires more people thinking about it, planning it, looking at what are the cases, like, you know, across the country. There are areas of this country that have, like, no services, but you have Asian communities.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Like... So our partnership is in, we've got five partners, us in San Francisco, LA, Atlanta, Chicago, and DC. So
what's up, New York? Did you say New York?
No, I didn't say New York. We want New York.
Let's get New York.
Yeah, I'm down for that.
I mean, Queens. It's right there. You
yeah.
know what I mean?
Yeah.
Well, those are the five partners. I mean,
yeah.
I was trying to make a joke about New York,
and it flopped. No.
So those are the five, and so those are your partners that you're trying to. Are you all working together to build this national?
Right. Yeah. So we're all our names start with Asian Americans Advancing Justice.
Gotcha.
And so the way we call it an affiliation. Mm-hmm. We're all independent organizations, mm-hmm. but we're coming together and we're sharing some resources. We're putting like money together in a pot mm-hmm. to do work on certain pieces. Okay. So like things like, why does it even matter? Like the census. Because we want our communities to be counted.
Right.
Because so many things are determined by the census. Like, mm-hmm. you know, the resources you get, the representation you get. So like that's one piece. But then we're also working on like national civil rights issues. Like, I don't know if you've heard about this Chinese scientist stuff.
No, I never hear about anything, to be honest, unless it's on ESPN.com.
Guys, I'm going to talk about, here's how Akash and I are helping destroy the model minority myth, is being as ignorant and stupid as possible.
Yeah, that's a cross that I bear, and I do my job.
And he does it well. I do it less than you do.
No, if it's not on Twitter, it's not even news to me.
So, coming back to it, we have not.
It was
heard.
On Twitter, by the way.
Was it really?
Yeah, it was on 60 Minutes.
Was it on Black Twitter? Because that's really the only Twitter I care about.
There have been four prominent prosecutions of scientists for being like spies or economic espionage across the country. And I mean, literally, these people have been like, one guy is a professor at Temple University, like, you know, SWAT team at his door, taking him out in handcuffs in front of his neighbors. Like, his kids are in bathrobes watching this happen. Like,
and these all four of these were
U.S. citizens.
U.S. citizens, but they were all East Asian.
Yeah, they were all East Asian.
Okay.
And, you know, there's this narrative now, like, China is the enemy. Now, this is the other part of being Asian, is like, you're the foreign menace. You know, and this is an old narrative in the United States, you know?
Yeah.
And like,
I mean, Japanese, China.
Yeah, or...
But did that ever happen for South Asians?
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you heard of the Bellingham riots in, like, 1905.
Then stop asking. Okay. I don't know if you can just take that out.
Yeah, so there were a bunch of, I think there were sick farmers or working folks in Bellingham, Washington, in the Western United States, and they were like literally like it was like a lynch mob railroaded out of town because they were an economic threat to the residents. But then it was like, you know, the yellow peril, the yellow. I mean, you should look up the article.
I didn't know this. My girl is sick, so that's how I like started learning about this. But Sikhs are always the group that's targeted. Amongst, well, at least Indians, maybe not all South Asians, but at least Indians. It's always just easy to go at six, it seems like.
So this was in 1905.
Yeah,
in the early 1900s.
Yeah.
So there became a narrative around South Asians not allowing us in or not us being the enemy.
Yeah. I mean, you know the Asian Exclusion Act, right? Like,
yes.
Right.
Kind of.
Okay. I need to stop asking those questions. So
I mean, I wish that you didn't, but you do have to stop asking us whether we know stuff because we don't.
Right. So there in the early 1900s, there were these crazy laws. I mean, we knew that there was like slavery and indentured labor and that, you know, African Americans were targeted and all that. But like even Latinos, Mexican Americans were very targeted. But for Asians, there were... Like, we're the only ethnic community that had a law that said you can't come to this country if you're coming from China, really? India, Japan. Yeah, there was a whole list. And, I mean, if you were already here, sometimes you were sent back, but, you know, you could stay. But you couldn't go back and find, like, for example, if you wanted... I mean, there were all these racial restrictions on marriage, right? So... The interesting thing is the Sikh farmers married Mexican American women in the Central Valley. So you've got all these.
Oh yeah, this I know. There's been articles about like the lineage of that and what that's meant for sure. That I actually knew about.
But part of the reason was they couldn't go back because home to marry, you know, Sikh women.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was and you couldn't. We also had alien land laws, like in California. You couldn't own, you know. You were stripped of your land. You couldn't own land if you were Asian. And, I mean, there was some Yeah, and I think people don't understand.
I don't think that's what I,
people
that's
don't
what
get it.
Well, this is because the second part of my question was about financing, and because I have this thought that, you know, and usually it's talked about with my, you know, friends that are making films and that are South Asian making films, and getting money in the South Asian community can be very difficult. It's that I feel like we don't know our history.
We don't.
And without knowing our history, I mean, I know that I'm woefully naive, and that's part of the thing that I love about getting to do this podcast. Is like I'm constantly learning something, and hopefully, you know, listeners are getting, and then, you know, getting it out there. Hopefully, we'll have. But it really is quite stunning. Our history is much. Oftentimes, I thought it was mainly 65 when we came here, but obviously not.
No,
we've been around for much longer, and knowing the things that it makes sense. Why we need to get involved. You know what I mean? It really places us, you know, there's so many, we joke that a lot of South Asians try to think that they're white here. And we're not.
No.
And if we know our history, it's easier to make that argument. And then it's easier to go to people and say, hey, listen, we're trying to counteract this. So this doesn't happen again, or it can never happen again. And hopefully people then are inspired to, you know, help support financially.
Yeah, I mean, I think that definitely is a piece of it. But then, you know, it's not just financial. I think there is this, we need enough, like, so like I told you, we have five organizations, and you're like, why not New York, and why not this? You know, like, you could add in a whole bunch of other cities. Why not Houston? Why not whatever?
Right.
And it's like, well, what, in New York, there are potential partners, but, like, in some of these towns, like, who are you going to partner with? There's no organization. Because we haven't actually built it, and that's okay. It will take time, you know.
But do you think that people haven't built it because they? Could you speak to that? Why?
You know, it's a good question. I've been thinking about it a lot. I mean, I think there's a range of things. Like, it is always harder, I think, for new immigrants. To build something, they're just trying to establish themselves,
right?
So it could be some of that. I think there's another piece of it that's about philanthropy. I mean, basically, so, you know, how a lot of nonprofits run is that we get funded by foundations, whether big or small, local folks, you know, your local benefactor or your local corporation that has, like, you know, a foundation attached to it, or nationals, like Carnegie, Ford, you know, MacArthur, you know, you've got all these. And the thing is, the model minority myth has really been problematic even in the philanthropic community, because their idea is Asians are fine. They don't actually need any help. They don't see the workers who are not, you know.
That's definitely an issue. We didn't know.
Yeah.
Can I also posit this? We aren't American enough. You say always, like, new people who just immigrated here don't really establish a lot. It's because I think we don't feel secure enough in our own status, not like as immigrants, but like our family. Let's set up our family. Let's do this. Let's make sure our kids go to a good college. I've been so concerned with me my whole life getting here. I don't have time to do this save other people thing.
I think it's an orientation. I have seen people who are immigrants who've gotten involved in their communities, but. I think this idea of community involvement is a relatively new idea for folks. So
it's just so strange because we're so family oriented. We're so
also, yeah, but your family is your community. It isn't your broader neighborhood.
Also in
you know?
India, from what we're hearing, what I understand is it was really like cool to be politically involved and active. So when you get here, suddenly it's not the people that are here. Are like, nah, I'm good. So I don't have a theory. It just doesn't really add up that in India, it's really like, it was cool to go to jail for protesting. It was like you were, it was cool to rebel and fight against the system. And like, that was the thing that was romanticized. We were talking to someone earlier, I don't remember who, but like his grandfather went to jail and it was like this in India for like a political protest. And it was like this thing that like the whole family talked about as this myth, this legend. And now it's like, if you get here, no one is protesting. There's no romanticism behind it. I didn't have a point like... a real answer. I was just bringing that up.
Yeah, I mean, I think you did, like, for example, in New York, the taxi workers did unite and, like, were, like, organized themselves and did engage in protests. But, like, I think you have to see that potential in order to like go for it. And I think we also need leaders. We need to develop our leaders. Like, you know, like that requires resources. You don't just like show up and now I'm a leader.
Well, let's close with this question to you. There's a lot that we've talked about and really important stuff, but it can feel overwhelming to walk away.
Right.
What are things to our listeners and honestly to Akash and myself, what are things we can do on a day to day? What is the thing that we can do? That helps?
I think you can do, there's a range of things you can do. You can be aware. You can educate yourself about what's happening. You can look around and notice that there are members of your community that need help. You can vote. You can be engaged politically. There are places where if you want to be a community leader, you can get trained for that. And I think, you know, for the older generation, I would really encourage them to open their minds to what their kids can do, because I think there is a real limitation sometimes of like, here are the three safe careers.
Right.
Yeah. And, you know, like, do that.
Right.
We will all benefit from having, I'm already benefiting from having you guys here, but like from having artists in our community, having teachers, having really a well-rounded community. Just because America constrained how we got here because of the immigration laws doesn't mean that has to be the narrow constraint of our identity as a community.
Can I ask one last question real quick?
Sure.
If it's as good as that.
It's a simple question. It's more of a personal question. How do you identify? South Asian, Indian, Asian? How do you identify?
I normally say South Asian. If I'm speaking to somebody who might know a little something, I might say Punjabi, because I'm really Punjabi in a lot of ways.
Okay.
And but, you know, I am Asian. I'm everything, you know. I'm not saying it to exclude people.
Right.
You know, it's more an insight into who I am.
So you almost say that you're a South Asian within the Asian community, which is part of a grander community.
Right.
Part of it.
Yeah.
A tiered situation.
Yeah.
We usually ask if people are available via Twitter or what, but maybe is there?
I have a Twitter. Yes.
Tweet it. Where can they find you?
She's looking it up, guys.
She's checking her phone.
Really excited about the Twitter.
We are not gonna.
I thought she was excited. Like I tweet all the time. I'm so glad you asked. But she got excited. Like I actually have a Twitter. I forgot.
Okay, that's mean.
We've been nice for 43 minutes. So.
Yeah, that's true. You're allowed.
This is rare.
The reason I'm saying that is because someone had a hard time finding. No, it's okay. It's at Aarti _ Kohli, and Aarti is capital AARTI.
_ Kohli. Kohli. KOHLI.
Right.
Tweet out there. And what is the website for the Asian American Advancing Justice -Asian Law Caucus?
You can actually just do asianlawcaucus.org. It'll get you there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, word. That's what I'm going to say.
Simplification.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. Sure. I think this is such an informative episode. I think it's really fun. And thank you so much for breaking it down in a very like easily to digest and understand way.
For idiots like
me. My pleasure.
Yeah. guys, our listeners, if you're liking content like this, we are, please share it with your friends and as we're talking about community, let's build the community so that we can, you know.
Wait, me first.
Oh, right. God damn it.
Just give it 5 stars, you stupid idiots. I have had enough of you.
I'm going to come in good cop. I love you all. And let's build our community, like I was saying. And there's multiple ways you can do it. Word of mouth. We put out a Facebook post. You can just press share. You can like our page on Facebook. You can... Those are mainly the ways to do it. You can retweet when we tweet our episodes out. Anyway, any way that helps you, that helps us, would build the community would be really, really helpful. Also, please remember, we're going to be dropping our community episode soon in the next couple weeks. So get at us. Shoot us your thoughts. Shoot us tweets. Shoot us emails so that we can talk about it on air. We are coming at you next week with another dope episode. I'm Arjun.
I'm Akash.
We'll catch you then.
God bless.